And of course, now you will hear the extended interview with Dr. Edgar Mitchell that was done over the satellite, with the satellite link, back on 25th of June 2007. The interview was initiated thanks to physicist Božidar Kemić, a great Croatian researcher. The host of the interview is Krešimir Misak. The interview was done for a TV show on the Edge of Science, where I am working as a co-writer, as I stated already. I was the one who wrote the UFO questions for Mitchell. Kemić has done the rest of the questions, and Misak has also put some of his questions too. So there will be more subject, not just UFOs, but I think it will be really, really interesting to you to get insight of the absolutely fascinating accomplishments and credits of outstanding American and world hero.
Good evening for the beginning. This is evening here. Please, can you shortly describe how you have been included in the Apollo program? What have prompted you to accept the profession as an astronaut?
Well, I was a Navy test pilot in 1957 when the Soviets set up the first spacecraft. And I realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And that sounded like an interesting thing to do. So I continued my test pilot duties and then started getting more education and got a doctor's degree from MIT. And that eventually led to being selected for the Apollo program.
Please describe to us your famous experience during your trip from the moon, which has directed your future life.
Well, the most important part of the return to the moon, from the moon, was to look at Earth and to see the heavens from the perspective of an extraterrestrial being off the planet. And seeing the magnificence of the heavens through the window of the spacecraft, and also through the little telescope we had to sight on the stars and align the platform. An utterly magnificent experience to be able to see the planet in that perspective. And all of my colleagues also agree with that. I mean, it's been a very powerful experience for everyone that's been to the moon and come back to look at Earth from the distance.
Some say that it is some kind of enlightenment. Would you agree with that statement?
Well, yes, it was an experience of recognizing and understanding from my days studying astronomy that the molecules of our bodies, the molecule of the body of my spacecraft, were manufactured in some ancient generation of stars. As you know, we know that matter is formed in the star system. And suddenly that idea became very personal. Instead of just intellectual knowledge, I could feel it. I could experience the connection with all in the universe. And it was an experience accompanied by bliss or ecstasy. And when I returned from space, that was such a powerful experience, I needed to study and find out what it was all about, because I'd never had such an experience. And I started digging through, with the help of some students over at the Rice University in Houston, I started digging through the literature, and of course I found nothing in the literature of science, but I found in the ancient Sanskrit literature from 5,000 years ago a description called Salvakalpa Samadhi, which is where you see things in their separateness, like we see them, but it's experiencing internally and viscerally as a unity accompanied by ecstasy. And when they showed me this description, I said, well, that's exactly what happened. That's the way it felt. And so I realized that the way nature is put together, when we are resonating with that magnificent aspect of nature, it does cause this type of internal ecstatic experience.
Is it too bold to describe the universe as an intelligent being, where the consciousness is the origin of everything? Is it too poetic?
Well, I don't quite hold with the notion that, with the idealist philosophy, that consciousness is the fundamental stuff. No. I do think that from our work in quantum physics in the last decade or so, that if we think of the quantum entanglement of particles, which we understand quite well now, quantum entanglement of particles and the non-local aspects of that entanglement, I like to define that or postulate that that is the most fundamental aspect of awareness we can demonstrate in nature. In other words, that particles that are entangled, regardless of where they are in the universe from each other, are instantaneously aware of something happening to the other. And if we define that as awareness, or they respond to it, and if we define that as awareness, that seems to be a most fundamental aspect of what we call consciousness.
Mm-hmm. How has your experience in space affected your view towards different scientific explanations? How have you started to view biology and the modern biological model, which is incorporated in our understanding of the world?
Well, the only thing that has changed, you see, is that I follow science and the protocols of science very arduously. The fact is that science is our modern technique for really verifying our perceptions and verifying what we think is true. But for 400 years, since the times of Newton and Descartes, the scientific community has avoided the subject of consciousness, believing that was more a theological subject than a scientific subject. And so only now in modern times are we getting bold enough to challenge those ancient ideas and say that we really need to understand consciousness from the point of view of science.
In the last few decades, DNA is very popular. What are your views towards DNA? Do you agree with some explanations that DNA is some kind of quantum processor for exchange of the information inside the non-locality? Is DNA hiding some other surprises in your view?
Well, yes, that may be true. I am not well enough schooled in molecular biology, nor in DNA studies, to be able to really speak strongly to that. However, what I can speak to is that in the last decade, or actually about 12 years ago, Dr. Schimpf in Germany discovered what is called the quantum hologram, which is a non-local quantum structure. And it seems to be sufficiently an information carrier and ubiquitous in nature. It's rooted in the emission absorption phenomenon at the quantum level of nature, and it seems to be a mechanism for nature. We can say nature is learning, that the exchange of information with that a material object has with its environment seems to be efficient to say that evolution is a learning system, not a randomly mutating system. And so that places an entirely different face on the way we look at biology and the way we look at evolution. And a very powerful approach, which I think is going to take several decades of work before we truly understand it.
When have you found the Institute of Noetic Sciences? What is the meaning of the word noetic? And what is the purpose of that foundation today? And what was in the days that it was founded?
Well, nothing has changed in the 36 years since I founded Noetics. Noetic in English pertains to how we apprehend information and generally pertains to our intuitive accessing information. The word derives from the Greek word nous, pertaining to mind. And the reason I formed the Institute of Noetic Sciences in late 1972, opened in 1973, was to bring, to study these phenomena, which science had refused to look at it for 400 years. It made me, the experience in space made me realize, as I looked at Earth from space, that we humans have asked the very deep questions forever of who are we, how did we get here, where are we going, and what is this universe really all about? And I thought that now that we're a space-faring civilization, that we need to re-ask that question from the point of view of a new perspective, with the understanding that science, in its most classic form, suggests that cosmology and organization of matter is simply a random accident of molecules bumping into each other and forming the reality we experience. And the idealist philosophy essentially said that it's all consciousness and it's an intentional event. And that matter is really just an amaya or an illusion of consciousness. Well, I really believe that the reality is somewhere in between those two extremes. And that if we started to study consciousness and using the tools of science, we might learn something. And, of course, that is what I started out to do 30 years ago. And we have made great progress. We don't have the problem solved, I believe. But I think science has made great progress in the last 36 years of making inroads into bringing a science to bear from the study of consciousness and using the tools of science to investigate these rather ephemeral subject matter.
How many people are involved in the work inside the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and can you describe to us some specific explorations that some researchers are conducting inside the Institute?
Well, most of the work at Noetic at these days is a more public orientation. The scientists there are certainly still working on we have a very small scientific group, about 10 people, but the organization, the core organization, has about 40 people in working on the study of transformation and its impact on social structure. And when I say transformation, the sort of experiences that I had in space and which are recorded throughout the literature for many, many years, that these types of experiences have been going on forever and having a profound effect upon human culture. And the point is that once we have had these type of experiences, and that generally includes the so-called near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences and such experiences. The Greeks called it metanoia, or change of heart, or change of mind, that you're no longer able to be violent. You find harmony in nature. You find peace in nature. You find peace in yourself. And so not only is Noetics a scientific institution trying to use the tools of science, but it's also activist in trying to promote the study of transcendental experiences and understanding how we bring about these in a better way. Certainly meditation, which is time-honored in our religious cultures and in the Eastern culture, meditation has been one of the honorable and ancient forms, but we've been working with new types over recent years that certainly do help to stimulate these types of introspective transcendental experiences.
Let's get a little mystical. Do you consider that it is correct assumption that with every action or thought we can affect the rest of the universe? Is there any available evidence that our inner world is connected with outer world?
Of course. There is a host of experimental evidence that our thoughts, when properly directed and intentioned, and our intention is correct, that we can affect physical reality. And we've experimented with this over and over again. And I think the concept of healing is the most powerful direct effect that we have observed. And I've observed it in many cases. It's been studied well. I've had it in my own personal study and my own personal health needs. We've done this also. So that is kind of a leading area in which to work, is using our mind and our understanding to help enforce and our own health regimens.
Can you describe to us your telepathy experiment, which was conducted during the Apollo mission? What were the procedures of the experiment and what were the results? Did NASA know about the experiment? Who was the leading manager of the experiment?
Well, I was the manager of it, but it was precisely the same protocols that have been used in the laboratories by parapsychologists for many years. I merely copied the so-called Zener symbols, the five symbols, the star, cross, circle, wavy line, and square, onto a pad, on my knee pad, and oriented them so that in random order, so that on any given day I could think about those symbols for a few seconds each, and the people on the ground were supposed to put them in the correct order that I was thinking. The results, there were four people on the ground. The results were as good as we had in laboratories everywhere. That chance could have produced those results one out of about 3,000 experiments, if it was a chance. But it was not a chance result. It was an intentional result.
Can you explain to us your cooperation with the Stanford Research Institute and with Hal Puthoff in the sense of ESP research during the early 70s?
Well, working with Dr. Puthoff and Russell Targ in the early 70s, we were working with a number of psychics, but particularly I was interested and helped sponsor the work with Uri Geller in 1972 and 3. And it turns out he was very, very powerful. We got some very good results. And also, work coming out of that, we found additional evidence of psychokinesis or mind over matter type phenomena.
You have continued to collaborate with Hal Puthoff to this day. What is the current point of your conclusions and explanations towards ESP phenomena when you include all the achievements in that field? We are talking about 30 or 40 years of explorations.
Well, Puthoff and I have not been in close working for all that time, but we have worked on quite a number of projects and been on a number of boards, scientific boards together. And we are both interested in these type of frontier problems, including the role of the zero-point energy field in nature and in cosmology, and the ability to perhaps tap zero-point energy for useful application. All these areas are still frontier science, but progress has been made.
What are the potentials of quantum fluctuation and the energy of zero point, namely the energy that is all around us? Can it be used as a source of energy? Can we describe and use that energy as a medium for phenomena known as mystical experiences? And what is exactly the meaning of zero point field? Is it some kind of universal source? Or what is it, in fact, in your opinion?
Well, the zero point field is very simply defined. It is well known that all matter emits and reabsorbs energy continuously. And what was discovered, that even when you reduce matter to 0 degrees Kelvin, or absolute zero, it's still emitting and reabsorbing quantum particles, even though molecular motion has ceased. And molecular activity ceases at 0 degrees, but the emission and reabsorption of photons continues, and so it's called the zero-point energy field. And it so happens that this is what Dr. Shemp discovered that if you studied the the emissions from matter as a group theory, instead of just single emission, and let me give a metaphor to help explain that. If you look at the swirl on your finger, it doesn't tell you, that little swirl on the ridge on your finger doesn't tell you much about you. But if you look at the swirls on all 10 fingers, that uniquely identifies you. It's your fingerprint. What Dr. Shem discovered was that if you study the emissions from, as a group, from all, from any object, whether it's the body, the building, or whatever, it carries information about that physical object. And that information we call a quantum hologram. It's non-local, as all quantum phenomena are, and carries information non-locally, so we can say it's carried in the zero-point energy field. And the evidence seems to suggest that it's the basis of all of our perception, that we have a saying in English, at least, that intuition is our sixth sense. But we really, if this information is true, it should be called the first sense, because it's based in quantum information, which had been around long before our normal sensory mechanisms were formed on this planet. It's the phenomenon of getting quantum resonance with something, which is this whole notion of interconnectedness. Getting quantum resonance is the same sort of notion that if you pluck a violin string in this room, a similarly tuned violin string will resonate across the room. Well, quantum resonance gives us this feeling of interconnectedness, and it seems to be responsible for all these phenomena, like I studied with Puthoff, remote viewing, all psychic type experiments. And it seems to be at the basis of our very basic perceptual mechanisms, all of our sensory mechanisms.
In the middle of the 90s, you have started to raise the question of UFOs. For example, on many public media, as BBC, you have stated that Roswell crash is an authentic crash of the extraterrestrial vehicle. On the basis of your knowledge, what has really happened in Roswell? You were living near Roswell, I think, and on the basis of your contacts and information, what you think about that incident and about UFOs generally?
Well, first of all, let me hasten to say I've never personally had a first-hand experience with extraterrestrials or UFO. However, I was born and raised, or rather was raised in the vicinity of Roswell, and my family knew many of the people involved in the so-called Roswell incident. And even though it's been was hushed up by our government, those people have continued to their dying day to swear that it was real. And I, because of my astronaut status, many of the people involved in the early days, I called them old-timers. They were military people, intelligence people, that were involved in the early investigation of UFO experiences. And they, I was privileged to be briefed by them, and they told me, because they were under security oath, but they wanted to get it off their chest before they passed on, that these were real things. And in addition to that, I was briefed at our Pentagon, because I'd asked some questions there a few years ago, and was briefed a high-level officer on what I knew. And he said, well, I don't know about that, but I will find out. And he called me a few weeks later and said, you're right on, these things are real. I should be in charge of that, but I'm not. And we do know that there have been very high-level people, politicians over the last years, from Barry Goldwater through Jerry Ford and others in our government, and President Clinton, Bill Clinton, tried to break into that circle of knowledge and were resoundingly rebuffed, and were not able to do so. So to me, it's a cancer growing in our midst that this information is known to some, but is being well hidden. However, that seems to be changing. There seems to be far more acceptance and openness now.
What is the reason for ongoing secrecy? Is it a valid assumption that it can lead to massive panic, or it is simply the matter of the monopoly on extraterrestrial technology?
Well, it's kind of the monopoly. It's grown from the early days in which there probably was an adequate reason that the military did not believe they could protect or do their job if it was truly UFOs or extraterrestrial present. So they were frightened of that, and they wanted it covered up. But it then became kind of locked into the system, and it's become a national scandal ever since.
If someone has really acquired the technology that is based on reversible UFO engineering, who could it be?
Well, if the technology, I would suspect that many of the modern sightings are homegrown technology, not alien technology. In other words, the vehicles are probably here. I don't know that for sure, but there seems to be a group, an industrial group, a military group that is in the know, and our President Eisenhower, when he retired from office in the late 50s, made the statement, beware of the military-industrial complex. And I suspect that's just precisely what he was alluding to, these hidden agendas and hidden technologies that are not available to the public at this point.
Do UFOs violate the laws of relativity? Namely, can we describe the UFO traveling inside the general theory of relativity, or do we need some other theory?
Well, I'm not sure that. There seems to be able to do that within relativity, but it really depends upon what the propulsion system is, and it does seem to be, from all we can understand, an anti-gravity propulsion system. But those of us who are not privy to the inner secrets of it can't say that for sure. But that seems to be the propulsion mechanism.
In your opinion, are UFOs friends or foes?
We certainly, if they weren't friends, they could certainly have taken us over by now. So I would say they're just observing and being available and watching what's going on. I don't have any fear of this whatsoever. We have more problems with our own culture and our warlike behavior than we do from the UFO phenomenon.
Do you think that other governments besides American are aware of extraterrestrial presence on Earth? Are there any other governments that have different and open attitude towards the issue without secrecy?
Well, certainly in the last few years, the Belgian government, the French government, the Soviet government, the Brazilian government, and the Mexican government have made open their files far more so than the United States have.
What do you think about the phenomenon of abductions? Is it manifested in our physical universe, or is it something more close to shamanic experiences that are occurring inside our consciousness as we think?
Well, I certainly don't consider myself an expert in that area, but I think there have been some valid stories of abduction, but I'm not a student of that, and so I can't really speak with authority.
Should UN be involved in the issue of UFOs?
Well, it probably, once we can get it opened up and it becomes public knowledge, certainly it'd be something that I would think all nations are interested in. There have been sightings in virtually all nations of the world that I know of.
What would be the reaction of humanity if we would found out that we are not only intelligent species in the universe? Is that standpoint difference today compared with mentality in the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, certainly it's different. I personally have, since I've studied astronomy 50 years ago, have been fairly convinced throughout all my adult life that the universe is inhabited throughout, that we're not alone in the universe. With all the billions of planets and stars, it'd be crazy to think we are alone in the universe. And I think in due course, as the more our knowledge expands and our science expands and our ability to look at distant star systems, we will understand that better.
What are your views about today's fundamental cosmological theory, the Big Bang theory? What are the main objections to this theory? Do you have any other theory in mind that you think it could be maybe better describe the universe or not?
Well, I believe there's work going on in that area, and there are quite a few cosmologists, I believe, that don't accept the Big Bang, and it certainly is problematic. And the alternative to it, it comes right out of this quantum holographic formalism that I'm interested in and Dr. Shimp has discovered and others are now working with. Because it shows a way that matter could have arisen simply out of the zero-point energy field and continues to arise continuously out of the zero-point energy field. And some of us suspect, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, that the dark energy and dark matter we now observe in the universe may be proto-matter that's just in the star, in the formative stages, and before it's incorporated into a star system and under gravitation to form even more complex matter.
Could you explain to us the idea that exploration of the outer and inner world are representing the next era in evolution of science and life?
Well, certainly the idea that we have to understand our inner processes, our mental capabilities, the neurology of our brain and our body. In other words, there's a great impact on biology to understand that quantum mechanics does not just pertain to subatomic matter, but pertains to macroscopic world as well, all scale sizes. And we're just starting to open that door into biology to understand biology has a quantum aspect to it. It will take us perhaps several decades, maybe two or three decades, before we can really exploit all the implications of this theory.
So you think that there is scientific evidence available that is pointing towards the spiritual side of existence? Can science and spirituality ever meet?
Yes, I think that much of what we have called mystical experience is able to be well explained with quantum principle. The ancients just, they intuited it, but they didn't really have the right interpretation of what was going on. And I think as we get the study of consciousness more accepted in the physical sciences, and the fact that quantum principles apply in biology as well, we will find some amazingly wonderful new things about ourselves.
You are involved in the issues of consciousness. What are your predictions about the development of the artificial intelligence in the future? What could be the differences between intelligence and consciousness inside the chip and inside the biological brain?
Well, mostly our artificial intelligence is producing and pursuing digital approaches. Now, it seems to be quite clear that our own consciousness, our own main brain biology, is an analog system, not a digital system. And so I have great skepticism that we will be able to really produce living systems artificially. And of course, the main key here is we really don't know what, in biology, we really don't know what makes up the life force, exactly why living systems are different from inert and non-living systems. For example, why is the carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen, and oxygen that makes up our flesh, why is it so different from those same elements in the natural state? We can say part of it is due to quantum interconnectedness and quantum principles, but there seems to be more to it than that. We really haven't found quite the secret to life yet.
One of the greatest mysteries is time. What is your perception of nature of the time? Do you consider that time is some sort of artificial creation of our consciousness, as some Eastern views and Western theories are suggesting, like the theory of holographic universe? What, in fact, exactly know about time?
I have a much more simple idea than that. I don't think that nature knows anything about time. Nature is process. All we see is processes in the universe, and time is just our construct to describe the speed of process. And based upon a model in our planet of the revolution of our planet and the revolution of our planet around the sun. So time is simply a mental construct. Is about process.
Mm-hmm. What are you writing about in your book, The Way of the Explorer, an Apollo astronaut's journey through the material and mystical worlds?
Well, it's basically, part of it is a biological, rather an autobiographical account of my trip to the moon. But the latter part of the book is about these areas we're talking about, quantum physics, consciousness, the fact that mind over matter type phenomenon, healing type phenomenon, because that is the frontier that needs to be explored, because classical science is simply not good enough. It's not, doesn't give us the answers we need.
Are space voyages practical inside Einstein's universe, in your opinion? Do you think that we'll be able to travel to the distant stars in the future? Because we have lots of limitations.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. We have to have considerably more science. But I'm sure that we'll be able to go outside our solar system by the end of this century if the progress we've been made in the 20th century continues, and provided we aren't stupid enough to kill ourselves off with nuclear warfare and terrorist-type activity.
What are the current views of universities towards your research of consciousness? Do they accept your findings? Is there any opposition towards Newtonians and Darwin's world views and towards dualism in physics?
As a matter of fact, it is finding its way into the university system slowly, but there are quite a number of universities, significant universities, that have studies in consciousness. And certainly the work in brain and neurology and biology and psychology are all coming together, starting to unify. It's been slow, but it is happening.
In almost 40 years of studying consciousness, do you have any answer to share with us? Something useful, something with meaning?
Well, the most useful thing is that our thoughts make a difference, that we can control our health and our well-being within, that happiness and peace that all of us want must begin within ourselves, and that we are far more powerful individuals mentally through our education and through our inner disciplines than we've ever thought ourselves to be. We're very unlimited when we can really reach our full potential.
Mr. Mitchell, thank you very much. This will be all.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Have a nice day.
Thank you.
You are listening UFO Radio International, hosted by Gideon Omerinkovic.
And that is all that we have prepared for you in this fifth episode. Thank you for your concentration. I hope that you have received some good data in our show. And until next episode, we will again try to do something that will be worthwhile in the sense of the best available UFO information. Best wishes and take care. This is Giuliano Marinkovic, and you are listening UFO Radio International.